this is Andrea Markovici, and I'll be at Joe's Pub on November 18th doing my show, Moonlight Cocktail, and I'm really looking forward to it. You're listening to Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio in Colorado.
Back in 2011, the Algonquin Oak Room closed after years and years of being this fairy tale place in New York, the ultimate meaning of what it meant to be a sophisticated partaker of New York nightlife. And the person that they got to do the last cabaret show at the Algonquin Oak Room after 25 seasons there was Andrea Markovici. She's an actress, she is a singer, and she turned 65 years old on Monday. Yay, Andrea. And to celebrate, she's doing cabaret again. She's doing it at Joe's Pub down on Lafayette Street, her new show called Moonlight Cocktail. So let us share a cocktail or two with the lovely, the talented Andrea Markovici in the neighborhood. Welcome, Andrea.
Thank you so much.
Well, you're very, very welcome. So,
matter of fact, I had all my birthdays at the Oak Room of the Algonquin Hotel. I used to celebrate every single birthday for 25 years. I can remember the waiters coming down the aisle with the cake, and I'm afraid the cake got smaller and smaller as the candles got bigger and bigger and bigger. And this is going to be quite a celebration, my 65th birthday on November 18th.
Well, it's amazing to think that you started doing these things at age 40. At the Algonquin Oak Room. And
What's
also nice is that you put it all out there. Hey, I'm 65 years old. Was there ever that thing that actresses have, and I guess singers too, of trying to be more cagey about your age? And
My mother told me I should hide my age years and years and years ago, but it's too late. You know, once you start giving an interview, if you give an interview early in your career and you actually make the mistake of telling them how old you are, then anybody can look it up. And in my opinion, it really doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter because I'm proud of being strong and healthy and enthusiastic at 65. I'm untouched and un-Botoxed. And I can, as I say, I can move my face at 65, and I'm very proud of being able to do that because when you're singing, you need to be very expressive. So I've left myself alone, and I wanted to see what I would turn out to look like at 65, and I think at least I look full of fun and full of emotion, and as a singer, you need to be. I'm proud of being 65.
Well, it doesn't.
So what is the alternative, really?
Well, exactly.
What's our alternative?
Well, I mean, yeah, but you lucked out in the genetic sweepstakes, too. I mean, for 65, you're still a rather beautiful woman. I mean, that's...
Oh, thank you very much. And my mother's turning 95, and she's still singing, and she's as strong as can possibly be. So, yes, the genetic sweepstakes, I think we won.
And is your dad still...
I lost my father when he was about 83.
Okay.
Well, my daddy is long gone, but he looks down on me from heaven and gives me great strength.
Now, when they were much younger, and you were much, much younger, how were they when you were telling them, I want to be an actress, I want to be a singer?
Well, my father, who was much older than my father was 63 when I was born.
Whoa.
And my mother was 29. My mother was a singer. My father was a doctor, but a magnificent ballroom dancer. And he played the piano like nobody's business. They weren't so crazy about my being in show business. I announced it to them when I was about 5. And they did try to keep me out of it for as long as possible, but I showed signs of it from the very earliest of ages. I danced, I sang, I wrote songs. I really couldn't be stopped. And in my first year of college, I had a wonderful, happy accident where I went to a party, and Arlene Francis was there, and I sang at this party, and she put me on the Merv Griffin Show. Going back a long, long time, the Merv Griffin Show. But I sang at that, and that was kind of the end of my college life. Managers came forward, and talent agents and casting directors, and pretty soon I was doing commercials, and then I was doing a soap opera, and then from there on I was really launched, as a singer and as an actress.
So did you ever finish a degree?
Oh, God, no.
Really? Oh, wow.
That's why I'm so proud of my daughter, who is in college today.
That's right. She's going to what? Lewis and Clark?
She's at Lewis and Clark in Portland, Oregon, and she's in liberal arts, and she's studying art and gender studies and literature and French.
Nice. Does she have any idea what she... Or is it way too early to...
It's way too early. That's why it's liberal arts.
Yeah. I know. And is she your only... Do you have other
kids? That means they can take yoga for 4 years if they want to.
Well, 3.5 years. But then they have to take an elective in meditation. That's how
yes,
it works.
Yes, absolutely.
Do you have other offspring?
No, just Alice.
Just Alice.
Darling daughter Alice.
And how long, may I ask, have you been married?
I'm married in 93.
Oh, yeah.
Separated about 8 years or so ago, but it never feels like it because my husband has always lived down the block, and we only recently divorced.
Oh.
But we talk 2 or 3 times a day, and I see him every day. It felt more like we just made the house bigger, we call it.
And you still co-parent. Well, I mean, she's away at school now, but you...
But we miss her so desperately that we have to talk to each other every day so that we can get this empty nest syndrome under control.
Right. So, now that you are officially a single person, have you been dating, seeing anybody? What's it like to be back out there?
I have a very, very, very strong friendship out here. And I really... It's just so new that Alice is not here that it's not something that I feel the need to be going out there. I love my singing. I love my... I'm not enjoying the empty nest as yet. I'm spending a lot of time reading and a lot of time rehearsing. So it's all right. It's all right.
Well, how much time of the year do you spend on the road? I mean, you're not just in New York or California, actually, but doing other concerts all over the place.
Well, when I had the Algonquin, it was 7 weeks out of the year at the Algonquin, and then I would spend 2 weeks in San Francisco and a couple of weeks in Florida and a couple of weeks in Chicago. It's a little less so now. I'm coming up on a wonderful tour right now of going to New York, and then Long Island, and then Westchester, and then Pennsylvania. I am going to Brownville, Nebraska, and Livermore, California, and I'll be back in Los Angeles on December 6th and 7th. In this coming 2014,
yeah.
I now have an acting manager, and I'm going to spend my time with the pilot season and hopefully resume my acting career.
All right. Well, this
more of a balance between acting and
yeah. Well, two different strings. First of all, strings of questions that I have from your answer there. First of all, you mentioned okay, New York, Pennsylvania, Long Island. I get it. And then you mentioned Livermore. What was it? Livermore,
near San Francisco, Livermore, California.
And there was another place in like what was it? Nebraska.
Yes, Brownville, Nebraska has a fantastic concert series where I'm going to be doing a Christmas show with Jeff Harner, Natalie Douglas, and Todd Murray. And I'm actually producer-director of that. I'm not actually Leslie Alexander's the producer, and I'm the director.
But it's just people would not necessarily think that places like the ones you're mentioning would have cabaret, but I guess the local concert halls at least do.
Absolutely, they crave it.
Yeah, well, they don't have a local cabaret club, probably.
Not a club. It's actually a small church.
Really? Okay.
It's a small church. And there's a fellow, Jim Keane, who has brought cabaret artists to Brownville for well over 10 years or more.
It's a wonderful thing because it's something you take...
I think it's like 15 years he's been bringing in cabaret performances.
And we take it, or when I was in New York, certainly you took it for granted that there was... You know, on the high end, you had Algonquin and Feinstein's and a couple of places. Then you had Don't Tell Mama and 88's and places like that. And still, some of those exist, and there are new ones now, like 54 Below in New York. But elsewhere, you know, it's one of those things that people think only exist in New York.
Right.
So it's kind of important that you've got people bringing cabaret to places like Nebraska. But in the years that you've been doing it, what have you seen as far as the changes in New York cabaret? Because it went through a pretty rough time.
We're at a little bit of a loss right now because we're missing the Algonquin and we're missing Feinstein's.
Right.
I believe that Michael Feinstein will open a new room probably sometime in 2014.
Oh, nice.
And 54 Below is going strong. The Metropolitan Room is going strong. Birdland, which used to be exclusively jazz, is now having more and more of our cabaret artists that have been misplaced by the loss of the Algonquin and Feinstein's. Birdland on 44th Street is doing more cabaret. Don't Tell Mamas is still there.
So of the places in New York that you're mentioning, which ones have you played and sung at? And what are your thoughts on the different performing
I'm
in them?
Well, I'm loyal to the Algonquin for my entire life as a singer. And then I had one season at the Café Carlyle.
Oh, wow.
Carlyle is rather glorious. It's the most expensive of all the clubs in New York, so it's a little off-putting to some people. And yet they're doing something very interesting now, which is they're having people do some late shows there. So there's a way of going to the Carlyle to see people at a late 10:45, at a 10:45 show.
And a less expensive...
And go to the Carlyle.
Yeah, because I think that's one of the things that may have killed, I mean, aside from the recession, that killed Feinstein's, was I just thought that place was overpriced. Not that the entertainment wasn't worth it, not that it wasn't a nice place, but I just thought, whoa, you know, people are going to be dropping...
We had a kind of perfect storm there with the recession and prices, and it did happen at the same kind of time.
What are some of your favorite memories of performing at the Algonquin Oak Room for 25 years? All right, well, yeah.
I mean, I remember so many things. I remember Pierce Brosnan coming, and there was a moment in a song that the word bond actually existed in my song. And everybody stared at him, and I stared at him, and I had to stop the song and say, look, I can't pretend that he's not here. He's so handsome, and we stopped the whole show because he was there. I remember when my daughter was just a teeny little thing and putting her on the stage and singing As Time Goes By, and she would sing along As Time Goes By.
Oh.
As I said, I remember all the birthdays. I remember times that there would be special times and flowers would come out and hundreds of flowers would be on the piano. I was lucky enough at the Algonquin that every year would be a brand new show.
Oh, my goodness. How long does it...
I never disappointed. I had a new show for 25 years.
Well, how long would it take you to conceive of a new show... Work on it, learn the songs, pick the songs, learn the songs, work with the musical.
I would work on a new show for a year. Workshop it at the Gardenia in Hollywood, workshop it up in San Francisco, workshop it again at the Gardenia in Hollywood, and then bring it into Manhattan.
Whoa. What would you learn, literally taking a show on the road, as it were? In other words, I mean, there's songs, you're singing them, and there's pattern between. What would you learn between the Gardenia room and back and forth?
Well, mostly... I don't like to write my show at a typewriter. Oh, boy, I am 65. I don't like to write the show at the computer. I like to write it on my feet. So I would prefer to have a nice long run trying the show in a couple of cities.
Mm.
What I learn is after I've written the script, I like to try it on my feet. Sometimes... There are marvelous little asides, is what I would call them, little improvisations that happen. Then I go home and I put the improvisation into the script, and the script builds and builds and builds and builds. So after three cities, the script becomes what it really ought to be. And without those cities, the script would be quite dry.
Nice. And then so by the time it's in New York, you're
loose with
it. A little bit of
stand-up comic, actually. The improvisation is as important as the original writing. The audience might give me some feedback, and I might give feedback to the audience, and then that becomes something that looks improvisational from the point of view of the person who is the third city, but the truth is it's already happened in two cities before them.
Cool. And do you work with the same, do you bring your musical director with you where you go?
My musical director goes everywhere,
right.
But I have three bass players.
Oh, one in California, one in New York.
I have a bass player in San Francisco, and I have a bass player in Los Angeles. I have a bass player in Chicago.
So what happened? Let's say you've got the show kind of ready, and you've done it in California. How much rehearsal then do you need with a bass player in Nebraska?
Okay. Well, we won't get a bass player in Nebraska because that's just we're an hour and a half out of Omaha, so we'll work without one in Nebraska, but. You know, 2 hours. Bass players are very, very, very spot on.
Right. Well, do they work from sheet music, or do they just know the song once
Absolutely sheet music.
Absolutely. Oh, okay.
No, they're not out there flying blind. That's funny. No.
So, and your musical director is your arranger. So
yes.
they'll write out the...
Shelley Markham, arranger, pianist, accompanist,
yes.
Musical director, everything.
Are there songs that audiences kind of... No matter what your new show is, that they sort of demand in an encore?
Not from me, because they're really used to me coming up with something completely new every year. There are other singers that have signature tunes that if they don't do them, then the audience would be upset. But for me, I think they expect something new. I mean, Moonlight Cocktail in specific, since I'm actually giving homage to other performers... to some extent, they may hear some things that I've done once or twice before.
And by the way, tell people a little more about Moonlight Cocktail, the premise of it and some of the songs that...
Well, it's really a tribute to a time in the history of the 40s and 50s when nightclubs were around absolutely every corner. And I'm tributing Mabel Mercer, I'm tributing Julie Wilson, Billie Holiday, Portia Nelson, Lee Wiley, Hildegard, I'll be singing Darling Je Vous Aime Beaucoup, Bobby Short, I'm singing I'm in Love Again, and my own mother, who, of course, I grew up with her singing around the house.
Yeah.
It's an exciting evocation of dining and dancing in New York throughout the 40s and 50s. It's a glamorous show. It's a romantic show, as all my shows are. And it just makes you feel like you've really walked back in time. And, of course, it includes the original song of Glenn Miller's, which is Couple of Jiggers of Moonlight and Out of Style, pour in the blue of a June night and one guitar. It's a wonderful song.
Oh, my God, I feel like I'm being serenaded right here on the radio.
I am. I'm serenading you and the rabbi.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The rabbi.
Well, the rabbi's in the other room, but he's listening very, very intently. He wants to ask questions, but you're Italian. You're not Italian, actually. You're Armenian, aren't you?
I'm a mix. I don't have any Armenian. I'm Romanian.
Romanian, sorry,
Romanian,
yeah.
Russian, Hungarian, Czechoslovakian, and Italian.
Have you ever done Romania? That's the rabbi wants to know that question. Lebedev's famous song. I think not necessarily in your wheelhouse, but
no.
Hey, well, speaking, we are talking, by the way, with Andrea Markovici, the delightful, the beautiful, the everything. What are some of the other cabaret themed shows that you've done in those 25 years of the Algonquin? Were there any particular ones that were particularly special to you, meaningful, or that went over so great, or you loved the theme of them?
Well, last year I did a show called Smile, which is, everybody seemed so upset about the recession and everybody was in such a foul mood that I literally created a show to make people smile. And I made it into a record, too, which is available. And I love the show. It started with a paper moon and me playing a ukulele. I did absolutely everything I could do to sing songs like, in the morning, in the evening, ain't we got fun, anything to make people smile.
And put on a happy face, that sort of thing.
That
right?
Ended up being a really lovely show. I loved it. I did a show, No Strings, which was all about travel and being footloose and fancy free. Oh. My favorite show of all the shows I've ever done is I'll Be Seeing You, the Love Songs of World War II, which I still do. I still travel with that show. I'm going to give that show a little Christmas spin, a little Christmas glow, and I call it now a World War II Christmas, and that I'll do in Livermore, and I'm going to do it here in Los Angeles on the 6th and 7th and create a Christmas, add Christmas songs to the World War II show. I'm very proud of my Rodgers and Hart show, my Johnny Mercer show, my Fred Astaire show. I loved the show I did about Ruth Etting because nobody really knew about Ruth. I did an entire show about Hildegard, about Gertrude Lawrence.
Wow.
I created long ago a Just Kern, an Irving Berlin. The shows are pretty much almost too numerous to mention.
Now, do you choose not, generally not, maybe you have in your shows sprinkled them here and there, but it seems like you're not really doing anything post 19, like, 60.
Well, I did once. There's an album on my website. Anybody, by the way, who wants to go to www.markovici.com, they can go to the website and then they can go to the CD selections. I did one called Our Songs, and it was all post 65.
Mm.
And I sang Beatles, Stevie Wonder. I sang Joni Mitchell, Judy Collins. And I did that a long, long time ago.
And you just
now
feel...
it's being done a lot right now.
Yeah.
But by a lot of artists right now. They're visiting Joni Mitchell and they're visiting Joan Baez and they're visiting Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, etc. But I did it already. I did it 10 years ago.
Right, but you're not necessarily going to sprinkle a song or two from the modernish era into what you do, except for that period of time when you did that one album, that one show.
I did in Smile. I sang a song by Pink.
Oh, good Lord.
Glitter in the Air.
There you go. Okay.
That's downloadable. That's a single download that you can get. And that was very interesting for me.
I'll bet.
And that's on the album Smile.
And how did audiences react? I mean, did they even...
They loved it.
Did they know who Pink was?
At the Carlisle, they were rather shocked. They loved it.
Good.
They really loved it, and I loved it too.
Because, I mean, yes, a lot of cabaret artists are mixing the Randy Newman and the Tom Waits and the Joni Mitchell.
Right.
But I'm noticing that usually
it's a real trend.
Yeah, which I think is great, because if you want to get people...
But what I love is they consider it contemporary when it's 50 years old.
I say Randy Newman, like, this is yesterday's stuff. And it's like,
I know.
No.
But it feels contemporary when you mix it up with something from the 30s. It clearly feels contemporary. Right. But when I remind myself that this is what I listened to when I was 10 and it's 50 years old now, I mean, it's really interesting.
Yeah. Although I don't foresee you putting any Kanye West into Moonlight Cocktail.
I don't think so.
Probably not going to happen. Not even any Jay-Z.
I don't think so. Although I saw Emily Bergel last night and she did something by Janet Jackson and she changed it into something quite touching, actually.
Oh.
Good job.
Cool. We are talking, by the way, with Andrea Markovici. We've been talking so much about your songs and your cabaret stuff, which is, of course, important because you've been doing it for about 3 decades now. But let's also not forget, as you said, that you're going back pushing more towards the acting as well. At least the next season you'll be going up for pilots and stuff.
Yeah.
People should know, first of all, you were on Broadway in a musical back in 1972 called Ambassador.
Yes.
With Howard Keel. Any memories? I sound like Joe Franklin when I say that, but it's true.
What I remember about Howard Keel is that he was perfect in every way. He was the perfect father figure. He couldn't have been more gentle. He couldn't have been more calm or loving. Just to be around him with his booming voice and his incredibly tall presence. I was just a baby. I mean, this was the very first thing I ever did. And unfortunately, it didn't last very long. We had our rehearsal period, which was divine for me to be around Danielle Derrieux and other actors and a wonderful chorus of dancers and singers and wonderful artists. And then, poof, 5 days later, we were closed.
That's the way it happens. I mean, there was another show that you were in that I actually saw you in. And I can't believe this is already like 20 years ago, by Frank D. Gilroy, the guy who wrote...
Oh, did you see Any Given Day?
I did, yeah. It was,
oh, you did?
Yeah, it wasn't the greatest show ever, but it was a worthwhile piece by Frank D. Gilroy, the guy who wrote the subject.
It's terribly dramatic.
The thing about that is I also remember at the time that it was the first show... being done by this thing called the Broadway Alliance, because Broadway was in bad shape back then.
Right.
And they were doing anything to get people to go see plays.
Right.
And I wonder if all of that overshadowed the play itself or any kind of news about the play itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, we were lucky to do it, and I thought it was pretty fascinating, and that was really the beginning of Justin Kirk.
Oh, my God, who went on to Love, Valor, Compassion, and I guess he's done some...
He's done very well since then. And, of course, it was Sadie Thompson who was in it with me.
Right.
And I had an Andy Robinson. And I had an absolutely wonderful time. My goodness, that was a thrill to be on Broadway, even though it was a limited run. Now you've got a ton of straight plays on Broadway.
Well, actually, that's almost... It's not a misnomer, but if you took away... Roundabout and Manhattan Theater Club, you wouldn't necessarily. They're the ones who are churning out two or three plays a season.
That's true.
So without them...
Well, and also, when you really think about it, perhaps we had something to do with having it be so acceptable, the limited runs, you know?
If you can get, you know, Daniel Craig and Rachel Weisz in a show for 3 months, the producers...
And then they seem to be perfectly happy with it.
Yeah.
As opposed to trying to get something open that's going to run forever.
Yeah. But check this out. You were also in a TV version of a David Mamet play called The Water Engine. I cannot believe this cast. William H. Macy, Joe Mantegna, John Mahoney, Charles Durning, Patti LuPone, Treat Williams, Felicity Huffman, Ricky Jay, and you. Please tell me you have some memories of this experience.
I don't.
Ah!
I'll tell you why.
Why?
All I did was sing. All I did was sing Paper Moon. I went in and did a pre-taping, and then I lip-synced to my song. I was just in the background in the scene. This was a really, really long time ago. And they just got me for a visual in the background of a sequence. So I got to say hi to Patti, because she was in her trailer at the time.
Okay.
But I never even got to see the rest of the people.
All right.
Of course, the pity. I wasn't in any acting sequences. I was just...
All right. But hey, if you don't have any stories from that...
But it's on my credit.
Okay. So is this. You did a movie in 1981, directed by Oliver Stone.
Yeah.
And co-starring Michael Caine. I wish I could do a Michael Caine impersonation like those British guys, but Michael Caine.
Michael Caine.
The Hand.
The Hand.
Michael Caine stories, Oliver Stone stories. Go.
Well, this was quite an experience, as you can possibly imagine. I mean, I adored Michael Caine. Michael Caine is the most charismatic, the most fascinating, he was wonderful.
Okay.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
He's such a storyteller, and you just want to be around him all the time. All the time. He couldn't have been... more eloquent, I wanted him to adopt me. I hated when every day ended and they'd say, it's a wrap, because he would absolutely just disappear. He's the kind of actor that just wanted to act from 8:15 to 5:15 or 6:15, never wanted to act a single second after the call. He loved his wife so much, he wanted to go directly home. We did have some time in Arrowhead where we were all in a hotel together, so there were some dinners where I would get to spend time with him and his makeup artist, which was sublime fun. Mr. Stone was on his best behavior, by and large.
By and large, okay.
By and large, he was on his best behavior. We made that movie to be a thriller. It was supposed to be a thriller, not a horror movie.
Okay.
So we were all very disappointed when, after the fact, after we finished the movie, they went back and were forced to shoot extra scenes of the hand crawling through things. And they turned it into a horror movie after the fact. Michael and I shot a movie that was just a suspense thriller.
Hmm. Well, I guess, you know,
it's supposed to be a psychological thriller, and if they'd let us make the movie we wanted to make, I think it would have been a little bit better.
Yeah. At that point, Stone wasn't calling...
It's a cult classic.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't... Honestly, to be honest, I don't recall seeing it, but I remember... Hearing about it, I remember Roger Ebert reviewing it and all that. I guess it's rentable.
It's a cult classic. And I can say that Oliver Stone was very kind to me.
Good.
Very kind to me. He was always very nice to me.
I mean, do you remember any either interesting, funny, or a bad day on the set, a good day on the set with him?
My biggest problem was working with the hand itself.
Okay.
Because it's a mechanical hand. And my biggest issue with it is that you've got a hand that is strangling you, and you're pretending to pull it off, but at the same time you have to hold it on. It's not a real thing. It's just a piece of rubber attached to a wire, and the wire is making it move, right?
Right, yeah.
But you're pretending to pull it off your neck. But the truth of the matter is, you're holding it on your neck.
Well, I mean, Edward D. Wood had the same issues when he was, you know, throwing Bela Lugosi around and telling him to, you know, keep the octopus off. No, throw the octopus off, you know.
Oh, it's the same thing. You know, it's a very, very funny bit of business to try to do it.
Oh.
Oh, gosh.
Now, speaking of another cult classic, you were in a film, and this is the one I want to hear most about, called The Front. It was during the Woody Allen heyday, even though it wasn't a Woody Allen film. He starred in it. I think it's a Marty Ritt film. And
Martin Ritt, Walter Bernstein film. Woody neither wrote it nor directed it.
So not only do I want to hear anything about Woody Allen, but the co-star in that film was Zero Mostel, and God knows I've heard stories about him.
Again, Zero was larger than life. Zero was... a huge figure on the set, and Zero was the type to entertain everybody. Woody was not.
Okay.
He was very, very quiet and would spend a lot of time privately with Martin Ritt and Walter Bernstein. Zero was always on the set amusing everybody and cracking jokes.
Well, that's great. I mean...
He was a very outgoing man. And he was incredibly kind to me.
Really?
Yes, very kind to me. And he came to me once and just said, "Hold your head up, darling. Let the light catch your face. Hold your head up." And it's the thing I remember the most. For some reason, he took a liking to me. Woody was also very good to me, but it was always terribly private. I remember thinking that the whole cast and crew wanted Woody to really be funny. But he wasn't funny. He was very serious and terribly quiet. And only funny, he would whisper something funny in my ears. But he wouldn't amuse everybody else.
Huh. And do you think it was a shyness or just his nature, or was he busy writing three movies in
very,
his head?
Very, very unbelievably private. And still is. I mean, it was his nature. It was an extraordinary movie.
Oh, it was a very good film, yes. That film I remember very well.
And I'm to this day very proud of it.
It wasn't just Mostel, but there were other people involved in the movie who were...
Marshall Bernardi.
Right.
And off the top of my head, I'm not going to remember who else. There were blacklisted actors and authors, and they tried to gather as many people that had actually gone through it. I mean, we were making it in the...
It was
1976.
Right.
So some of the experiences for them in the 50s were, you know, still somewhat raw, and certainly Zero's experience was very raw.
Wow.
And that scene where he jumps out of the window was so brilliantly shot. I can remember that very clearly. I saw the movie so many times.
That's an interesting thing. You've seen movies that you've been in.
Only that one. I thought that one was so extraordinary.
Because I wonder if you
could watch that one.
Yeah.
You know, fairly regularly, or watch scenes of it fairly regularly.
But can you pull yourself out of it? Since you were like the female lead, the love interest, etc., in that film, can you kind of pull yourself away from it when you're watching a movie that you're in? Or when you're on screen,
not
it's
usually,
like,
usually, I mean, usually you watch a movie you're in, it's kind of through your hands, gritting your teeth.
Right, well, yeah, but I'm saying that, but with that film you're okay, you can watch the scenes you're
yeah,
in and get involved in the movie.
That's just a brilliant movie.
Hmm. Are there any other movie experiences or stars that you have worked with that you have particular fond or non-fond memories of?
If I had non-fond memories, do you think I would tell you?
Well, let's say if their actors are dead, you know, you can tell stories out of school, especially if you're not going to work with them ever again, you know.
No, it's not my nature.
Okay. Well, what about fond ones?
Well, I adored and still adore Tom Selleck.
Oh. Everybody likes him. Yeah.
What a heartthrob. Oh, my gosh. I had more fun than A Barrel of Monkeys with Danny DeVito.
Oh, my God. On Taxi, that's
Taxi.
Right. Yes.
Oh, my God. They taught me how to be funny.
What did they teach you? Literally, I mean, how did they do it?
Well, Jim Burrows and the cast, you know, just said, be yourself, because I was a drama queen at the time. And they said, just exaggerate. Just exaggerate who you actually are and keep a straight face, which was very difficult with all of them around. But they were incredibly encouraging.
Oh, good.
And Danny really, really taught me how to do it. And with Jim Burrows, of course, a terrific director at his side. And they just said, overdo what you would do ordinarily in a serious victim role. And boy, did it work. I have strong memories of that. I have very powerful memories of being on Trapper John with the divine Gregory Harrison, who I always got along with very well. I did so many Trapper Johns.
Oh, good.
I did two Trapper Johns as a guest, and then they brought me back to actually do a six-part a leading lady opposite him. We ended up walking off into the sunset together at the end of the series.
Oh, my gosh. That's not a series I remember very well, but that's so
yeah.
Cool that you were you closed the Algonquin and you closed Trapper John M.D.
I did. They can blame me for everything.
Well, you didn't close Hill Street Blues, although you were on that for...
I was on that for four episodes, too.
Cool. So now you're looking to not get back into acting.
And
you never left.
Get
but.
Back to episodic and maybe a good solid part on television. That would be wonderful for me.
So for people who aren't in the biz, walk us through, like, when someone like you goes to be part of pilot season, what exactly does that, you go to California for 3 weeks, you make, I mean, how does it work?
You have to be here for a few months.
Months? Yeah.
And then you take meetings and you go to auditions and you hope for the best.
So your agent,
like what anybody would go through. Right now, you have a lot of movie. You have a lot of movie talent that's doing television.
Sure. Well, sure. That's where, not only where the money. Well, some of the money is, but it's also where a lot of the best work is being done now. Has shifted.
Well, there's
into
some
TV.
Terrific work being done in television right now.
And thanks to cable, especially and stuff.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of it, and we shall see.
Now, here's a question for you, and who did I ask who didn't want to go there? And I had an interview for a magazine. I was interviewed. Oh, she's on that Cedar Cove cable show now. Andie MacDowell. And she didn't want to answer this question. Let's see if you will. Especially back in, like, the 70s when you were really concentrating on the movie, you know, trying to get an acting career up as much as the singing. Were there any parts that you auditioned for that, you know, you wish you'd gotten that, you know, other people ended up getting and then you had to go see them at the movies or on TV?
Well, there was a turning point in my career I don't mind this.
Good. Okay. Because I find it a fascinating question. It's like, what were the auditions like? What did you, you know...
Well, it's a huge difference.
Yeah.
There was a time that I was being considered for Winds of War, and Jane Seymour did it, and I was in serious contention for Winds of War. And had I done it, it was exactly the time that I began my career at the Gardenia and started to develop my nightclub act, my resurgence into cabaret. And I'm fully aware that had I gotten Winds of War, I would never have had a reason to bring myself back into cabaret, because I would have been totally busy,
right,
sure, with the movies of the week, and I would have been in an entirely different world. So it was a destiny that was mine.
Wow. So some things that weren't meant to be were meant to be, is the basic thing.
Yeah.
And that's a wonderful answer. So I'm so glad I asked that question. So glad that Andrea Marcovici answered it. Got one or two more quickie questions for the wonderful Andrea Marcovici, who, by the way, let us remind people that on Monday, 2 days from now, not only is it her 65th birthday, but she's celebrating with everybody who wants to be there at Joe's.
And please remember that there are some tickets at Joe's Pub for only $20. We did a special gradation of ticket prices so that we could add younger people and students and everything for $20.
Wow, and you don't even have to stand across the street at Blue Man Group outside. You know,
you
can be in the room with her.
They're very good seats. We just wanted to make sure that we could gradate the ticket prices into something that was very fair.
Which is great.
But I don't want young people to feel that this American Popular Songbook is not theirs. It's a legacy that we must hand down from generation to generation.
And if you get them when they're 20 and 30 now, hopefully, then they will become the 40, 50, 60.
Mabel Mercer had young people coming to see her all the time.
Right.
I don't see why I shouldn't.
Well, people have two, and you're doing two shows, by the way, at Joe's Pub.
Yeah, a 7 and a 9.
7 and 9 at Joe's Pub. And let me give a quote that you once said. A cabaret singer, like an actor, is a storyteller. There's a through line in the performance, a beginning, a middle, and an end. Cabaret singing is a tried and true art form. I agree. What did you learn from when you were doing cabaret 30 years ago to when you're doing it now?
Well, you mean 30 years ago when I first started, or
Well, that was 25 years ago at the Algonquin. But let's say the process, like what you were doing when you first started singing.
Well, when I first started, I was a little bit too nervous to talk as much as I do. I was a little too nervous to go out into the house as much as I do. I was nowhere near as funny. Sorry, if I do pat myself on the back.
The hilarious Andrea Marcovici.
Oh,
she's
hilarious.
Here all week, ladies and gentlemen.
I didn't have a sense of humor about myself. I was too serious.
Oh.
And as you get a little older, you start to be more self-effacing, which is something I learned. And I didn't have anywhere near the swinging rhythm that I do now as well. So much changes, my goodness gracious, as you grow.
And it's gradual, or were there moments
very
when...
Very gradual.
Yeah.
Very, very, very gradual. It's 27 years. In 27 years, you should pack up your bag and go home.
No, you know better than that. Certainly not.
It's just a very gradual process of learning and being interested in things, and as you have influences from songs that you've learned and studies that you study, people that you're interested in. I mean, I'm singing a Lee Wiley song. I've listened to Lee Wiley, so that changes something. Everything.
Has your voice changed at all?
My voice has changed, too. It's a little bit higher, which is odd.
Higher?
Higher, yeah.
See, that I wasn't expecting.
Okay. It's higher.
So you've moved more towards the soprano and away from
I don't know why. Go figure.
What songs can you do now that you couldn't do, not just content-wise, but as far as just vocally, could you do now that you couldn't necessarily do?
It's more in the arranging. I mean, I have a slightly different range. I can't really belt the way I could in my late 30s. I can't.
Well, I don't think people saw you as a belter.
No, I was never a real belter, but I did have a stronger chest voice. And now I'm a bit of a lighter singer, that's all. I don't mind it.
Well, nobody might. Nobody would mind listening to Andrea Markovici singing. I guess the last question for you would be, how long will you be doing this?
Until the cows come home.
See, I told you you're not going to quit.
That's what my mother would say.
Yeah.
Until the cows come home.
If your mom's still singing.
I will always be a proponent of the American popular song, and you absolutely never know what I'm going to think of next. I see no reason, as Mabel Mercer never quit, I see no reason to change my focus.
Nor do I, nor should anyone. That's why everybody's going to see Andrea Markovici Monday night at Joe's Pub to get her CDs. What's your website again?
www.markovici, just the last name, M-A-R-C-O-V-I-C-C-I, markovici.com. And there's some terrific CDs that are there, including Smile, the most recent. And there's a great Christmas album, and there's one called As Time Goes By, which is the greatest hits.
Lovely, lovely. Andrea Markovici, by the way, happy birthday to you.
Thank you.
And thanks so much for being in the neighborhood with us.